This course is part of the Superstar Teachers series. The series is produced by The Teaching Company. This course is titled Nietzsche and the Postmodern Condition. The lecturer for this course is Professor Rick Roderick. Professor Roderick received his bachelor's degree at the University of Texas at Austin. He did postgraduate work at Baylor University and earned his Ph.D. at the University of Texas. From 1977 to present, he has taught philosophy at Baylor, at the University of Texas, and now at Duke University. Lecture 1, Nietzsche as Myth and Mythmaker.
Well, be an introduction to Nietzsche that I've called Nietzsche as Myth and Mythmaker. I'd like to say a little bit about his life because there's really not too much to say about it. It'll only take a few minutes, I think, to summarize. He had a really unexciting life. And so that we need to distinguish right away two things. One is what I like to call the Nietzsche effect. And I'm a child of the 60s, so I'm very familiar with the so-called Nietzsche effect. And that's the effect that Nietzsche has on adolescent young males who read him for the first time and begin to name their cars Ubermensch wagons and begin to quote Nietzsche in order to date women who dress in black as I'm dressed today. And the Nietzsche fascination. That characterizes one's first encounter and certainly characterized my first encounter with Nietzsche as well. We need to distinguish the Nietzsche effect and also the effect of his texts from his life radically, because his life is, in my opinion, you know, from what I know about it, extremely boring. Someone asked me before the class, well, was Nietzsche gay? Well, he wrote a book called The Gay Science, but he didn't publish it, you know, in San Francisco or anything, and it's not about gays. Nietzsche probably only had one sexual encounter in his life. It's likely that that encounter, that he contracted syphilis in that encounter, so this is hardly the subject for a miniseries. I mean, this won't make it to Dallas. He was a brilliant young man who got a job teaching in a German university, at a very, very young age. In fact, if you know the German university system, a remarkably young age. But because of migraine headaches and problems with faculty meetings, things that I'm very familiar with, he quit and traveled and wrote books. So in a certain important sense, the books that I will be talking about, the texts that I will be discussing, are his life. And so questions about his biographical history, I'll give you just an outline, because Nietzsche, in an important sense, is the last thinker of the 19th century, and also, in another important sense that I'll be arguing, I hope, throughout the course, one of the most important thinkers for our present moment. But Nietzsche was born in 1844 in Germany, of course. I only talk about Germans. I guess this is established policy now, right, to concentrate all our policy on Germany, Japan, and the Soviet Union. And he was from one of those three. He was from Germany. He had a rather famous but brief friendship with the composer Wagner. That's about the most exciting thing, so you know, I'm not going to say much about it, but you know, he had a famous friend. He wrote a lot of books that we'll talk about. He was raised by his mother. His father was a minister, a rather sickly person, as he was throughout his life. So if any of you have had some brief acquaintance with Nietzsche and the doctrine of the affirmation of life and all the hyperbole about health and the Superman that appears in his text, it would be a shocking contrast to have met the real Nietzsche at one of the little resort towns where he used to hang out and find this dapper, rather quiet European man who was extremely ineffectual. This wouldn't be your view of Superman, for sure. Anyway, Nietzsche, the Nietzsche that we know in the texts isn't dead yet, the Nietzsche is writer, but Nietzsche died in 1908, and I'm sorry, in 1900, on the nose, which is nice if you're a historian and you like to periodize. He died at the end of the 19th century, but as some of you may also know, Nietzsche went mad 10 years before that, much to the delight of various commentators, Christian commentators and others who argue that anyone who took some of the extreme positions and series of positions, if one wants to attribute them to Nietzsche, about God, the argument is that, you'll go mad or you'll change your mind in a foxhole or whatever. So his madness has been a consolation to many, and certainly it was a consolation to his sister, who made the most obscene uses of him afterwards. By the familiar picture we have of Nietzsche as a person is, if you look at this portable Nietzsche, which I suggest to everyone as the first encounter you should have. It was sort of designed for that. You may have seen other books in this series, the portable so-and-so. Well, this actually is an excellent little text. But look at the sort of sketched-in picture of Nietzsche with the big mustache. Well, this is the way his sister had him wear his hair and dressed him. During his life, he had very short hair, no beard, no mustache, very dapper, and his sister had him grow out this sort of prophet-like beard and dressed him in a cloak and then would bring people in to show them her famous brother. This is very Germanic. It's just strange. Here is Nietzsche. Yeah. Beard, cloak. So I'm not going to say much about his life because his life was a pathetic ruin. His texts, on the other hand, have not suffered the same fate that he did as an embodied, suffering human being. To approach the text of Nietzsche is difficult. And this format adds one additional paradox to the paradoxes with which we're about to begin. There are at least two sets of paradoxes that concern Nietzsche as myth and mythmaker. The first are those paradoxes that are within his writings. For example, and we will cover these as the courses go on, Nietzsche will suggest that morality has an immoral origin, that rationality has an irrational origin, that truth has its origin in fiction, and so on. So those are the paradoxes that we will deal with within the text of Nietzsche. Those are paradoxes that any interpretation of Nietzsche would have to address. Any interpretation of his work would have to address those. And my task of doing a course on Nietzsche would be difficult enough if I just had to address those. Those are tough. The second sets of paradoxes make it even more of a problem. And that's the paradox generated by what might be called generated by his writing instead of the paradoxes within it. The paradox generated by his writing, by his pluralism of styles. He wrote in fragments, aphorisms, jokes, all kinds of metaphoric tropes. He also wrote treatises, and in fact, in a plurality of different styles. Many of them, the most famous and most discussed ones, are in these short either parables or aphorisms, which are hyperbolic, exciting, brilliant, and have, as I say, received a lot of attention. But the paradox generated by his writing is that the clear sense emerges from Nietzsche's project that it is, and this will be a central issue. Now, I'm not saying we're going to settle this in here, for God's sakes, because I don't know if it's settleable. But a central issue of his writing will be the so-called impossibility of interpreting. And many of the issues we're going to discuss are going to concern interpretation. So please don't think that interpretation here is a special philosophical term. I want to try to bring home to you the practical importance of interpretation, and then I'll return to the paradox. We interpret all the time. I mean, whether, we don't interpret in the specialized scholarly sense, but we interpret all the time. When we look in a mirror, when we dress in the morning, and you may notice that we're similarly dressed. I mean, if an anthropologist would notice that we shared much more in common in our dress than differences. There are many background conditions and interpretive conditions that go into dressing, presenting one's persona, and so on. There are many background conditions and interpretations that go into an act as simple as stopping at a red light. Now, we don't call all these interpretations up and explicitly discuss them, but there was a time when you didn't know to stop at red lights. There's an entire set of traffic regulations mutually adhered to, which embody all kinds of legal interpretations, and that's the background against which even a simple act like that will be performed. Interpretation in a more obvious sense takes place in the political realm all the time. So if you followed the Clarence Thomas hearings and I've promised in these lectures not to go off on my political digressions, so I'll try to keep this one brief. But if you follow the Judge Thomas hearings, you'll notice that questions of interpretation arose again and again in a quite practical context. By that I mean something hung on what he, on both what he interpreted he had said in the past and on how he would interpret in the future. So interpretation is very important. This can also be made clear historically. Although we don't make a big deal out of interpreting the Bible anymore, we adopt a kind of live and let live attitude based upon our real smudgy belief in God. Now, that USA Today belief, you know, they ask in USA Today how many Americans believe in God, and 98% say, well, yes. In the normal American factoid way of believing, it's just you're asked if you do, and you don't want to be embarrassed. Oh, sure, yeah. But there was a time in the history of Western civilization when people burned because they read a book with the wrong interpretation. I want you to understand the interpretation, a lot depends on interpretation. Because they interpreted the Bible, the biblical text wrong, whole groups of people might burn. So there are stakes to interpretation. So as we discuss this throughout the course, please don't think that this is some airy, stupid, academic dispute. In fact, I would argue that the last 10 years of political life have been about the attempt to kill the very desire to interpret. In a certain way, there's been a certain trajectory, social trajectory, which the text of Nietzsche addresses that involves accepting surfaces and to kill the urge to interpret in anything but the most superficial way. And that will be part of the social and political aspect of the argument I will develop, okay? Now, no thinker, and I'm going to avoid calling Nietzsche a philosopher. The reason is that I know a lot of professional philosophers, and I don't want to sully Nietzsche's memory in this way. Nietzsche, the writer, we will call him, a kind of writer, is importantly engaged in interpretation that will lead us not only into these contemporary issues, and into theoretical issues, but he won't stay with just theoretical issues. They will be profoundly, importantly practical issues. Okay, well now, back to the second paradox. Nietzsche's work suggests that in a certain sense it may be impossible to find what many people think they find when they interpret. Namely, the right interpretation. One of Nietzsche's primary targets is the notion that there is such a thing as the right interpretation. In general, that's what makes it a theoretical point. However, the paradox now is obvious, right? Because the paradox generated by his writings is, if that thesis suggested by his writings were correct, then the ideal way to present Nietzsche would not be to present an interpretation of Nietzsche, but to do what he suggests in other places in his work, which is to develop a creative, brilliant performance of one's own. That sort of created oneself in a new way, and if one used Nietzsche's name, it wouldn't matter whether one, or it might matter if it made the performance better, in what way one used it. But that's a very peculiar way to look at a book. In other words, a series of texts that suggest that there's an impossibility in getting them right. And it's not what we standardly, I think, or most of us standardly believe we do when we interpret. I don't know how many of you are familiar with things like Southern Baptist conventions. I don't attend them, but they take interpretation very seriously, and when they debate it, someone's is right. Generally, the person who just offered it, arguing with someone else. But I mean, the underlying idea is that an interpretation can be the right one, especially in regard to a text like the Bible. This is a deep belief that also runs throughout universities and has generated a current debate at the universities over the losses of standards and objectivity. Because according to, for example, Alan Bloom in The Closing of the American Mind, and according to Buckley and many other conservatives, now labeled neo, most of them have gotten older, and as they get older, they're now called neo. I will drop that. I will call them paleo conservatives. Paleo conservatives find in Nietzsche a very troubling feature of a figure because of this effect generated by his writings, that interpretations are multiple, contestable, and might finally be judged by which end up being the most interesting. On the other hand, they might be, some interpretations might be in place simply because they are backed by the most power. Point we'll get to in a later lecture. That many interpretations may be in place not because they're rational or argumentatively supported, but simply because they're backed by the most power. Once this specter's been raised about interpretation in general, then it looks like we have attained a sort of insight, if we do, and we're going to have to follow the text of Nietzsche, for which I'm just preparing us now. If we do think this is an insight and follow it out, it seems to make the university a very, you know, odd place, because then when the philosophy professor puts his Plato notes on the board or her Plato notes on the board, the student has no reason to think that that's any more interesting than their own notes based on their own reading, apart from the institutional power of the person presenting, apart from that. Well, this is the notion, of course, that's outraged Bloom, because this destroys standards. Well, whose standards? Well, of course, people like him. Academics, their standards. It reminds me of the scene in Full Metal Jacket, where the drill instructor says it's okay to believe in God when you're in the Marine Corps. Your heart can belong to Jesus, but when you're in the Marine Corps, you play our games, we play our little games, they play their little games. You know, God plays his little games. He loves Marines. That's not the actual line. I can't do it here. He loves Marines. We keep his, you know, heaven filled with souls, and so he lets us play our little games. Well, academics are kind of like that drill instructor. And if it turned out that they didn't have some special, this is in the humanities in particular, but the argument might even hold across many areas of science. But I hope you follow the point. If academics didn't hold a certain key to interpretation that their students needed to decipher and pay money in order to learn to decipher, they wouldn't have anything to do for a living. Do you follow me? They wouldn't have anything to do for a living. And I don't want to make that sound crude, but on the other hand, I don't want to lie. It is crucially important in the political economy of the university to try to deny Nietzsche's insight for this reason. If it is one, we will argue that. Because if it is one, it's paradoxical, because it will mean that what I'm now saying and the lessons I'm drawing from this insight, which is that interpretation may prove to be undecidable or impossible or whatever, if that is an insight, the challenge it poses is that people would have to begin their lectures by saying things like this: I'm paid a lot of money and I have tenure at a very famous place. You will now take notes. Instead of beginning with, this is my methodology carefully developed over years of study. In other words, one would begin to see then what Nietzsche suggests in text after text, which is that the origins of such methodologies are in relations of power. That the methodological languages, however sophisticated, will in some sense instantiate those institutional powers. Traced to their origins, they will themselves prove to rest upon undecidable and interpretable material and not upon the facts themselves. So it will be a consequence of the effect of Nietzsche's text to make us at least question whether we can come up with the right interpretation of a text, of a situation, of a person. I mean, interpretation, again, to try to make it concrete and not some academic matter, interpretation is very important. For example, you've fallen in love for the first time and things have been going great, and then one night you're out and you look and the person frowns for a few minutes. And a whole train of interpretations may start off that are humanly important. This is not, you know, grad school. This is stuff you want to know about. What is this frowning business? It's been going great. I don't know what's the frowning. So interpretation's a rich human matter and not a theoretical matter. Okay, now let me get back to my starting points. The first one, we'll have to deal with the text generated by Nietzsche's specific positions and the work within his writings, and we will do that. The second is the paradox generated by his writings, the paradox, what I call, we'll call the paradox of interpretation, one which I have not yet spelled out Nietzsche's case for, but I will as we go along. And then now we come to the third and, for me, most interesting paradox, which arises from my own situation here, lecturing on Nietzsche in a new medium at the trajectory of a culture that Nietzsche saw as one that was leading to what he referred to as nihilism, the last man, the death of a certain form of being human. And to present that, to present the first set of paradoxes, and then to try to give you a sense for the paradox generated by his work, and then thirdly, to do it from this position, and in this context and in this culture, presents for me a third and deeper personal subjective paradox. Because on the one hand, I don't want to leave the text of Nietzsche as the possession, as a sort of esoteric possession of snooty elites. Not happy with that. On the other hand, I don't want it to lose its striking power by being somehow trivialized in the process of presenting it, which puts me in a third position. And I guess that, given also the second one, it generates another problem, which is, why am I here doing this instead of one of you? So I have to give an answer to that right away, and I'll start with a blunt one. And that's that I've probably read more of this than you have. That's just, that would be the answer you'd get from your mechanic about fixing a carburetor. Well, I've read the carburetor book. I've fixed these things. You go, well, I've never fixed it. And you go, okay, you try to fix it this time. So there's one analogy. And if one of you has read more, then you can come up here now. It's okay. I mean, I won't be offended. Just whatever. I'll have to leave that joke out. We'll cut that one. Another kind of example might be this. Doing Nietzsche might be something like housework, just something that has to be done over and over again, not trying to denigrate the unwaged labor under capital performed by women. That's how I describe housework. Unwaged labor, valorizing capital done by women, unwaged. But I don't want to put housework down, because I think that's, it should be waged at the very least. It should have a wage. But in any case, it may be that interpreting Nietzsche will have to be something like housework, work to be done over and over again by a whole series of people who read and reread Nietzsche. In other words, I won't be up here trying to claim the authority of Nietzsche for anything. I will be making a kind of use of him. Now, that won't release me from the full paradoxes you'll see as we begin to look through his work. In fact, we'll just have to deal with a lot of paradoxes as we look through his work. And for people who enjoy neat and tidy lecture courses that have a lot of demonstrative arguments with conclusions that are necessary, this is really the wrong morning or afternoon for you to have shown up, because that will not be what Nietzsche offers. What Nietzsche offers is a lot less, if you're a professional philosopher today. By that I mean a lot less being no arguments that could be symbolized and then put into one of our journals, which are read by 11 people, who, if they were all killed on the same bus, no one then would ever know about the journal again. 11 people read some of these things, or 12, if you're popular. In any case, those are the three sets of paradoxes. Text, paradox within the text, paradox generated by the reading of Nietzsche, and then the third, the paradox that belongs to anyone who attempts to present Nietzsche's text. Okay, now that's an introduction to what I will do. Now, the first topic, and it's listed in the lecture, is myth. And one of the things that Nietzsche is, among many other things, and now that I say Nietzsche is, the Nietzsche as proper name refers not to this pathetic little man, you know, and his terrible little life, but to the texts of Nietzsche. Okay? Remember that I've made that distinction. And I'll try to explain that one, too, as I go along. But one of the things that we need to look at as we go through that is that myth will be one of the topics of the text of Nietzsche that's very important. And it won't be that Nietzsche discusses myth in detail, although frequently he does discuss myth, or that he uses myth in his writings, which he not only does, but in the case of Thus Spoke Zarathustra, he creates one of his own, quite beautiful, quite brilliant. I'm sure some of you have heard... At least, you know there's a piece of music based on it. You're probably familiar with the prelude to it, which opens 2001, A Space Odyssey, the sort of Übermensch, Overman prelude. Anyway, myth is not only used by him, he doesn't only create one, but the topic of the relationship between myth and what some other philosophers have called modernity, modern life. I'm sometimes tempted just to simply call it capitalism, and usually will, modern life. To try to make that come alive, you need to think about films like Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times. You have a sort of pastoral life, kind of pastoral, farming and stuff, and all of a sudden real fast machines. It's one way to visualize modernity. Another way is in the text of Kafka, these lines of bureaucrats, faceless little Joseph K's wandering towards an impossible justice. That's another way to imagine it. A way to theorize it is to read thousands of pages of Max Weber, bore you to death. Boring, but it will help you theorize it. So modernity is connected, importantly connected, with the Enlightenment. And we will have to discuss Nietzsche as in a certain very important sense, involved in what I will refer to as the dialectic of Enlightenment. He will be involved in both a critique of the Enlightenment, a criticism of it, but then he will, of course, make use of its insights at the same time. And the critique of Enlightenment that Nietzsche originates accounts for the title of the overall lecture series, which is The Postmodern Condition. Because if in any sense at all we are either in or headed toward a situation after modern life or postmodern, a term that some of you are familiar with, then certainly an important figure will be Nietzsche, both for the myth that he constructed about such a life and for the myth I just constructed that he may have had a role in constructing such a life, because that's probably a myth as well. Okay. Now, the importance of Nietzsche. I mean, this is, now we're going to do a little standard academic treatment here. The importance of Nietzsche. One of the reasons that I selected this course is because it's always good to discuss a thinker who's discussed in Time magazine and becomes the topic of routine polemics on Buckley and elsewhere. That's important because that's a part of our objective culture. It's a topic for conversation, and that makes your remarks more understandable and gives a real social purpose to doing it. So Nietzsche's importance is, as I said, in a sense, obvious. Nietzsche is the main target in Bloom's book. He is the study of Nietzsche, along with, I think, looking at Woody Allen films. Let me try to locate the fall of Western universities in Bloom, okay? If Mr. Bloom's in the crowd, I'm sorry. But anyway, Nietzsche and German philosophy, mainly Nietzsche, Woody Allen films, and the dark music from Africa that started influencing American youth. Sort of. We don't want to call anyone a racist, but that sounded funny to me when I read it in The Closing of the American Mind, this dark music of Africa. What could he be talking about? Well, I mean, we all know that Mick Jagger looks like a photo negative of Little Richard, but I wondered what he was talking about. In any case, there's the neoconservative attack, the paleoconservative attack on Nietzsche, makes him an interesting topic of debate in one sense. The current debates over interpretation in the areas of law, politics, and elsewhere make him an interesting figure to discuss. And then there's this issue of Nietzsche's return, which I would like to make historically contextual for you. I discussed, being a product of the 60s, my first encounter with him, and many young people encountered him at the time, and it was exhilarating, because as we read through these texts, we will see that Nietzsche's always valorizing youth, creativity, life-affirming activity, always valuing misinterpretation, polemically, hyperbolically, inciting people to laugh at authority and so on. And so there was a great exhilarating effect of Nietzsche in the 60s, which I think sort of washed out in the 70s, early, mid, late 80s, the way most things did, kind of settled into sort of a 30-something whining. I mean, I don't know the people who make that show, I'm sorry, but I mean, I watched it a few times and it was just... just... Suicide, please. Anything but this, you know? I mean, Abby Hoffman, whatever. Anything but this whining, pathetic, pale shadow of a human life, you know? But then a younger generation comes along, and we have what's called Nietzsche's return. And this began in the late 80s. And the return to Nietzsche at first was quasi-nostalgic, and then it became humorous. And I also want to bring some of that in, because there are many humorous, and I mean, it would be absolutely out of the spirit of Nietzsche not to do this. There are many humorous uses for the text of Nietzsche. There was an issue of Semiotext magazine, which I really enjoy. I don't know how many of you have ever even seen Semiotext. But it's a bizarre little out-of-the-way journal that publishes all kinds of strange esoterica on the edge of the academic discourse. Bizarre conspiracy theories, strange political theories. And they did an issue on Nietzsche that began with a box that checked off style of interpreting Nietzsche, and it's the first one was shameless opportunist, you know. The second one was joker who's never read Nietzsche. Third was serious but confused academic, and you just checked off your box and mailed in the result of the survey to Semiotext after having read some of the articles on the new Nietzsche. And that, actually, the thing that was the most in the spirit of Nietzsche in the whole issue was that box. Because Nietzsche has a tremendous, and I mean one of the reasons that one can stand Nietzsche at his darkest moments in his text, one reason that one can tolerate looking some of Nietzsche in the face and being able to stand it, is because of these moments of incredible hilarity. I mean, just absolutely hilarious. I'll try to generate some of those as we read through here, because Nietzsche does, I think, as we proceed, we'll see that Nietzsche isn't a place to go for consolation. You know, this is not a place one would go for consolation. As you wouldn't pick it up like one of these feel-good pop psychology books that I find in the airports all the time. For every group imaginable, you know, unbelievable culture. Yeah. Books for depressed housewives ages 25 through 31. I mean, I didn't know you needed a book. You've got 8 talk shows. Why'd you need a book? Books for depressed husbands, ages 27 through 40, so on. And just everybody's kind of depressed. And these are, well, Nietzsche's texts are not a place to go for consolation along any of those dimensions. In fact, one of the things that will be importantly denied in my account, it may just be mine, but in my account of Nietzsche, will be the very possibility of anything like a psychology as anything more than just one more narrative about yourself that you decide to adopt. And I mean, you can do that, right? I mean, in fact, it's disheartening today how frequently you meet someone a few years later and, oh no, I'm off the Valium now, you know, I'm in the Reverend Moon's church and I'm off the Valium. I mean, who knows? People, today what Nietzsche saw as an incredible project, which was to invent oneself, now is a marketable thing. I mean, that it's a mod. You can go to the Gap and invent a persona, read a few of the right magazines that go with the clothes that you buy at the Gap and so on. So self-creation in an intensified market economy is something that Nietzsche would have had to deal with had he unfortunately lived longer. But he claimed to have lived out of season, and I will claim that his view is relevant to our own times. Now, let me return for a moment to this interpretation business. And then a few quotes from Nietzsche. I think that we should use a little Nietzsche to spice up the opening. We've talked about these three sets of problems, three paradoxes, including my paradox of trying to present this, both by doing justice to the wit, the interpretation, developing my own strong interpretation, and doing it under a changed mode of communication, which is extremely important in Nietzsche. He's a writer. A writerly writer. He's been referred to as someone who wanted to play Plato to his own Socrates. Let me explain that remark briefly. And this may help introduce you to Nietzsche a little bit. Playing Plato to your own Socrates would mean this. Socrates didn't write anything. Some of you may know that. Socrates didn't write. Plato wrote about him. So it was as though Socrates sort of lived this character that comes down to us in the constructed form of Plato's narrative, about which it has always seemed to me to be totally uninteresting to ask, was that really what he was like? For God's sakes, we don't even normally want to know that, really. I mean, if you've seen a great Billy the Kid movie, and there have been so many that a few of them have had to be good, right? You see a really good Billy the Kid movie, it's not fun to go, was Billy really like that? Who cares, you know? I mean, because that one was interesting and fascinating. So Plato's Socrates is such a fascinating character. I'm not sure what Socrates was really like. There are reasons, I think, and Nietzsche makes some of them clear, why in principle I couldn't be sure about that. Part of our fascination with time machines might be with interpretation, actually. Maybe our fascination with time machines, you know, like Back to the Future, Back to the Past, and now Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventures Through Time. I like some of those, but I'm digressing a bit, but forgive me here. Bill and Ted's latest bogus adventure is a parody of Ingmar Bergman's The Seventh Seal, where they go to hell and play Twister and Battleship with the Devil instead of chess. That will be a symptom of a postmodern culture. See, modernist humans will be worried about death. It will reverberate in sort of their being. And because there won't be a field of meaning to answer it, the problems of life and death, we will get the problem called nihilism. But when you cross a certain threshold point, a threshold point where people's real issue is, am I alive now? And that question seems radically undecidable. Then you get cultural artifacts like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, where the best response seems to be a kind of giddy, silly ecstasy at the very inability to have a self. I mean, I can't say that I don't share some of the fun of it for our younger generation of quasi-cyborgs that will be raised in this postmodern culture. They will be unrecognizable, perhaps, within a few generations. Everybody's saying, oh, well, that's impossible. Let me try to generate this kind of historical change that Nietzsche was one of the first to foresee and to discuss, and which I will discuss throughout this course under the heading of nihilism, and that will be the social and experiential side of the problems of interpretation, although they're also experiential to me. And that's the problem of nihilism is the problem of finding meaning in a world that is no longer God-centered. That did not mean for Nietzsche, any more than it did for Marx or Weber or the other people who gave accounts of modern life, that there would no longer be a lot of religious people. You follow me? And it didn't mean that there still wouldn't be churches and believers and there still wouldn't be holy wars and so on. It meant that an overarching cosmological story into which you could fit, that provided a background of meaning and a place for you, would be radically missing. And in its place, there would be market relations, in which what you were would amount to what you do for a living. So all a lot of you know about me, I do have a couple of my ex-students in here, but all a lot of you know about me is that I do university stuff for a living. See, that's... And that isn't a remark about my predilection, which is something I've talked about before. This is over my predilections. It's a mark about my profession, but it's more than that. Under these social conditions, it is an absolutely ontological remark about what I am. You know, when people at a dinner party say, what do you do? That is not a trivial remark. It's a story about a culture. What do you do? Answers what you are. Now, I know people resist this, and I enjoy the resistance. You know, at dinner parties, you go, well, I'm a writer. Almost a joke if you're at a dinner party in New York. I'm an artist. I'm a performance artist. I'm a writer. And you find, well, but I mean, you know, what do you do? They go, oh, I drive a cab. I wait tables. But I'm, you know, my third novel is, I'm working on it. Yeah. Now, this is a culture, this is full of market relations, where the construction of meaning becomes the burden of a newly constructed category, the individual, the bourgeois individual, the individual of modern life. The individual competitor on a market, in a market. No longer the member of, like, the community of God, in the broad sense, you know, of the feudal period, but someone who must construct the meaning of their lives in singularity. Let me say that instead of alone. With their, you know, sort of in singular, with their own resources. And that is a task that Max Weber thought would overburden them. And it's a task that Nietzsche thought almost impossible, but one he undertook, as I said earlier, by trying to become Plato to his own Socrates. In other words, not to actually live an interesting life like Socrates, but to write one as though he had lived it, a kind of deferred relation, but still to make meaning out of his own life in a context, and this, again, this word nihilism, I'll say a little bit more about it, in a context where the threat was nihilism, a culture where there was no fabric from which to construct meaning. Now, nihilism, in a certain way, then, won't be used by me to describe a philosophical position, because to the extent it does, it's supposed to be some silly position like this. Nihilists are people who believe in nothing. Well, if that's what nihilists were, there wouldn't be any, and that's not what we're diagnosing. We're diagnosing a nihilistic culture where no enduring beliefs can provide meaning for the overwhelming majority of members of that culture. That's the problem that Nietzsche identifies coming along with modern life. And also not coming along as a mystification, but coming along as part of the inside of modern life. Comes along with Darwin. In other words, being demystified about our origins. It comes along with a new view of the cosmos, being demystified about the importance of the earth. You know, where it is and how big it is and in the center of what. Being demystified concerning a whole series of things about which earlier there were powerful, important, meaning-giving myths. Part of the work of the Enlightenment was this destructive work of destroying myth. That was the work carried out by the bourgeois class and by its ideologues. I mean, it's not bad. I mean, you remember they said, we won't have a decent world to live in until the last priest is hung on the guts of the last king and stuff. I mean, well, those are the mottos of the great revolutions. This is Washington, D.C., right? These are the great bourgeois revolutions. We love them, and they may be, in fact, a world historic destiny. Nietzsche's worry was that this kind of demystification, without creating new festivals, new games, new myths, would lead to a situation in which human beings willed only not to will any longer, who wanted sort of only not to want any longer. And Nietzsche saw this emerging culture as one that would be inimical to human life, about which, as I said, he doesn't have a lot of consoling things to say. So I'm gonna read a little passage of Nietzsche and try to stop there to give us a frame within which Nietzsche views human beings. Now, I don't think this is all that theoretic, and I don't want it to be. I want it to be something that you can grab a hold of and understand, because this is kind of a modern myth I'm about to spell out for you. In fact, I may not read it. I may just gloss it. It's a modern myth that I'd like to spell out for you that many of us believe. And let's see, after we've examined this myth, if this is more or less comforting than the beautiful myth of redemption in, say, for example, the Bible. The myth is something like this. There are billions and billions of stars. The earth is a tiny one. We crawl across it for just a few seconds, and then we individually are gone. There are billions and billions of eons of time before and billions afterwards past. And the earth eventually goes out like a cinder, and perhaps the whole universe collapses into itself. And after all that's happened, absolutely nothing will have been done. Now, that's a very important myth. Many of us believe that one too. But against that background, it becomes difficult as we chip away at our daily little lives, selling shoes, selling tires, teaching class, to try to find any damn thing that means anything. So our search through Nietzsche will not be a search for dogmatic answers to that question, but to follow his quest and ours for a form of self-creation under circumstances and with a background of myths that do not make it seem likely that we will have a happy result. So the end of my first lecture is that our interpretive efforts here too are bound to fail.